I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, in a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked the EPA's ability to limit mercury emissions and other pollutants from coal-fired power plants. Writing for the majority, Justice Antonin Scalia said, "It's not rational, never mind appropriate, to impose billions of dollars in economic costs in return for a few dollars in health and environmental benefits." The agency now has to rewrite the rule, taking costs into account. According to our guests, poor and minority communities bear the brunt of the costs of this kind of pollution, other toxic pollutants, and climate change. They join us to talk not just about this ruling, but efforts to make the environmental movement more racially and ethnically diverse and to include environmental justice in environmental policies. Let me introduce them to you. Joining us from WAMC in Albany, New York, is Aaron Mayer. He's the Sierra Club's 57th president. Its first African-American president was elected May 16th of this year. Aaron Mayer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. I like to consider myself the clean power president who happens to be African American.
Okay, fair enough. Let me introduce our other two guests. Jackie Patterson is the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. And I know, Jackie, you have a bit of a cold. So thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Sure. And our third guest is Adriana Quintero. She's a senior attorney, director of Latino Outreach for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And Adriana, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And Jackie, nice to have you with us. And Jackie, hope you can take care of that cold. Aaron, let me begin with you. I'd just be curious about your response to what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Monday.
Well, it's really a shock, but not a surprise, given the leaning of the court and its pro-corporate stance. Again, this is on top of the history of corporate personhood. They've granted with Citizens United corporations free speech, and to now elevate it to the next level, where the cost to a corporation is much more significant than the health of human beings within the United States and citizens. Just think about that for a moment. So they're saying we do not care about the citizens' right as a human being and their right to clean air, clean water, and clean soil, but the burden in pursuing that, if it is too high for a corporation or a corporate citizen, their rights tend to trump human health rights. And so it's very disturbing. And as a community in upstate New York, which is upwind from the Ohio River Valley coal plants, and witnessing the damage here in the Adirondacks, but as well as the asthma-related illnesses, say in New York City, upstate New York, throughout the Northeast, this is a very tragic and disturbing ruling.
To you, Jackie, and I know you did a report for the NAACP a couple of years ago about these coal-fired power plants and their effect on poor and minority communities. What were your findings?
Yeah, so we found that 68% of African Americans, actually that had even been found before by other folks who are looking at these same correlations, but the 68% of African Americans live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant, and that low-income communities as well as Latino and indigenous communities were also more likely to live near a coal-fired power plant. We also found that in certain areas that we studied that there were higher rates of asthma, higher rates of respiratory conditions, and other conditions that are tied with the types of toxins that come from these coal plants like mercury, arsenic, lead, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide. And so, as an example, African-American children are 3 times as likely to enter into the hospital for asthma attacks and 2x as likely to die from asthma attacks. And that there's a higher rate of lung disease, but a less likelihood of smoking among African-American adults. So we start to see how all of this ties together.
I mean, does that go back to coal-fired power plants, or are there other issues or other potential impacts in effect, Jackie?
I was still talking about coal-fired power plants.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, sure.
But you're saying cause and effect there. The fact that there's a high rate of asthma, you can trace back to coal-fired power plants.
The same toxins that come from coal-fired power plants, like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, are also tied with exacerbating respiratory conditions such as asthma and other respiratory illnesses. So absolutely, as it stands, there it's difficult to make a direct tie to say that this coal plant caused this asthma attack, but we do know that those toxins exacerbate asthma and other respiratory conditions, and that those the rates of those types of illnesses can be higher in the areas that are surrounding coal-fired power plants.
Adriana, let me get you in on the conversation as well. I'll be curious about your reaction and also the impact of these power plants on the Latino community.
Well, Jackie's completely correct. The impacts can't be denied, and they've been studied for a number of years and more than proven. So the truth is that right now EPA can and should complete its analysis promptly because this rule does, in fact, have a tremendous impact on human health. Mercury is a neurotoxin. It's a brain poison, essentially. And all of these pollutants are really impacting our human health, no matter who you are. Unfortunately, as Jackie pointed out, some communities are more impacted than others. And when we look at the health benefits, they simply can't be dismissed as minimal. They're extremely serious. We're talking about preventing 11,000 premature deaths, close to 5,000 heart attacks a year, and hundreds of thousands of asthma attacks. When you look at that in work days missed, in emergency room visits, in medical costs to many communities that are already impacted or that are uninsured or underinsured, that is a true economic and health burden on families. It can cost families jobs if they can't take time off to care for their loved ones or for themselves. And truly, it's disturbing to see those health benefits that we all are going to see dismissed as minimal when compared to industry costs. The good thing is that the industry truly is, they run a business too. And a lot of these things that we're seeing is that while it's great for them to be able to say, hey, we want to keep polluting, let us do this because it's a big cost to us, a lot of the corporations that are taking action have already taken action. We don't anticipate that those are going to be reversed, but these types of rulings are always harmful, especially to those most vulnerable.
Aaron Mayer, do you see this as a form of environmental injustice, even environmental racism?
Yes. And in fact, as you know, over 28 years ago, Dr. Ben Chavis and Charles Lee, who now works at the EPA, who was a special project assistant and associate with regards to the toxic waste and race report, they did the first statistical analysis and data analysis that literally looked at where toxic facilities are, where polluting facilities are, where waste sites and hazardous sites are. And controlling for everything, they found that while poverty was clearly very high, but race mattered. And so not only is the issue, did it underscore the consequences of NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, but is something that Dr. Robert Bullock called PIBY, which is put it in black people's backyard. So environmental racism is critical, but where's the intersect here? At a regulatory framework, the public, you know, the citizens, they vote for their legislators. And not having the ability to power, and this is where reapportionment and voting rights from the NAACP ties in, without the people having the choice to elect a politician, they lose a voice with regards to the regulatory framework that defines where these places are sited, but more importantly, how these entities are regulated. The conservative Republicans and those who attack and assail voting rights right now, they try to frame the issue as in blacks choosing black candidates, and that's far from the case. The issue is choice, and so that any citizen, regardless, and again, it's civil rights, regardless of their race or color, are able to choose a politician that represents their views, but more importantly, has a powerful say upon the regulatory framework that may have a detrimental impact to their health as well as the environment. And what we have found is that as we have discriminatory electoral regimes and the discriminatory policies that deny people the right to vote, and this is why we've engaged with the NAACP and the labor unions on the Journey for Justice marches that will be beginning through the South this year, you know, these are direct correlations as to disempowerment with regards to the regulatory framework that is absolutely impacting their health. So the answer is not only do you have an intersect with regards to voting rights, But this intersect with regards to voting rights, the failure to elect politicians who are crafting rules and frameworks results in discriminatory practices and policies. We just only found that, for example, the Citizens Council, which during the 50s and 60s was called the White Citizens Council, a very notoriously racist organization and entity, is a critical funder and financer of the Republican Party and conservative policies. And these are the people, by the way, who gave us the Scalias of the world. So it is not surprising that we see, as they say, decisions, while on their face appear colorblind and neutral, have profound, statistically disproportionate impacts on communities and people of color. And so we can see them making the trade-offs, sadly, at the judicial level, that the same politicians at the congressional level are making when it comes to race and how these pollutants and things are handled. Remember, the country produces over 25 billion pounds of toxins a year for the stuff that we enjoy in life. It's that stuff that has to be manufactured somewhere, and the pollutants have to go somewhere. And when it comes down to race, we're finding that more and more where it goes and where it's dumped and where its air is destroyed happens to be communities of color.
Jackie, do you see this connection between voting rights, redistricting, and environmental policies and environmental impacts?
Absolutely. And to answer your question about environmental racism, it definitely, as Adriana said and as Aaron affirmed, is environmental racism when the lives, the thousands of lives that are impacted by this rule are relegated to insignificance when it comes to a calculation of valuation. And so when you have lost lives, as we said, lost days of work and lost days of school in terms of educational potential, and that's being just dismissed as negligible compared to the investments that are required to have clean air and clean water, that's absolutely an environmental racism issue, and it really raises up that same clarion call for Black lives to matter in this context. So, but to further make this tie in terms of voting rights and civic engagement, absolutely, even as you look at the folks who are making the decisions, whether it's the decisions around zoning, the decisions around permitting, and we talk about the public utilities commissions and the public service commissions, across the board, there's a disproportionate lack of representation of African Americans, Latino Americans, Indigenous Americans on the public utilities and public service commissions, which will make decisions about these energy policies. And so right up the chain, we see where the decisions are omitting the engagement of the folks who would have a stake in and have a familiarity and understanding of the impact of these decisions on communities.
Well, we have to take a very short break. I do want to pick up on a couple of things. That's Jackie Patterson. She's director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Also with us is Adriana Quintero. She's a senior attorney, also director of Latino Outreach for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And also with us is Aaron Mayer. He's the Sierra Club's 57th president, just elected in May 16th. Of this year. We're talking about minorities, climate change, and the environmental movement. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about the disproportionate impact that climate has been having on minority communities, on poor communities. I do want to talk about the racial and ethnic diversity, or perhaps lack of diversity, in the environmental movement. And again, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Adriana, let me begin with you, only because I want to make sure we're even, Stephen, for all three of you. Has the environmental movement, from your perspective, been too concerned about polar bears and wildlife and preserving open land?
Well, I don't necessarily think that that is the problem. I think that the problem has been the fact that historically the environmental movement has not done a good job at reaching out to a diverse enough group of people. I think that that is, yes, in part due to the issues that have been the great focus, but I think more than anything, it's been the way that these issues have been conveyed. When we talk about the classic environmental movement, so to speak, the focus on open space, for example, there it really has been conveyed in a way that does not broaden the conversation to include the number of people and the variety and diversity of our country. It's really been very focused towards a very small portion of our country, which are white, very educated Americans. And even then, it's been liberals and it tends to be people in certain parts of the country. So the truth is that it's less about the issues and more about the way that we talk about these issues. We're not taking into account the fact that a lot of people are coming to these issues from a different position culturally, from different experiences in their lives, and also with that different concern. So I think that that's where you start to get into, are we talking enough about health and the environmental movement? If you look at it, yes, health has been an issue for throughout, but the way that the images that the environmental movement has used, the wording that we've used for so many years, leaves out a huge part of our country. It fails to recognize the importance of talking to people whose experience is not out on a hill alone hiking, and doesn't recognize the fact that maybe your experience is in an urban center, but you still care tremendously about the health of your environment, of your neighborhood. So we've seen the environmental movement, I think, to put it simply, has treated the environment as something that is over there rather than where we are. If we start to talk about the environment as where we live, then all of a sudden we'll find that a number of people, whether it's Latinos, African Americans, or whites, have a different perspective on environmental issues. And that's when we truly will start to go towards diversity. Otherwise, we put ourselves in a bad position where we're actually making the case for those who oppose many environmental regulations because it puts people versus places. And that should never be the conversation in environment. We are part and parcel of the environment, every single one of us.
To you, Aaron, I know you got involved in the environmental movement and in the Sierra Club because of a solid waste incinerator that was in your neighborhood in Albany, and you organized people to protest it and try to shut it down. Was that your entree into this movement, such as it is?
No, my entree into the movement began as a kid. I grew up in northern Westchester in Peekskill, New York, and to go back on your major point, it's not as if people of color don't care about wild things and wild places and wild spaces. If anything, it is the history and legacy of this country relative to people of color in the environment and land use. Remember, this is all about land use and who has a say. So how this nation is structured since its inception has always been that, you know, the great white male thesis. But in fact, it was the First Nations who were here first, Native Americans, and the Forced Nations, basically enslaved African blacks, who built the roads, highways, and byways, and who were agrarian people who were connected and well settled to the land. I descend from sharecroppers in South Carolina in the Blue Ridge Mountains, who we meet regularly there. I come from the hill countries in Jamaica on my paternal side. So people of color are intimately connected to the environment. And again, go back to the earlier point, it's the issue of the conversation that assumes that because whites define blacks or Hispanics or Latinos or Asians as urban population, it is that bias and as they say, typecasting of an entire segment of America and their voices as if they don't have a relevant say in what's happening. In fact, we have a huge say because when we talk to about the management or stewardship of, as they say, of indigenous lands through the Department of Interior, it is the mineral rights and gas lease rights that's on Native American lands and takings of these lands against even the treaty, the wishes and desires and treaty limitations with regards to how these things are extracted and, as they say, in their lands violated, they don't have a say in. But again, white males in Congress and or the executive branch have a say. So it is the issue of powerlessness that comes from the, as I say, the institutions that, you know, at a number of levels, whether it's the political level or in the case of the organizations to react to the bad politics, that people of color have been systematically locked out as if they have nothing to add to the conversation. And let me give you the consequences of this. We had a governor in the state of New York, David Patterson, and the consequence of, as they say, locking people of color out of the environment, you know, they have then that low green IQ or low green connectivity. And that's what businesses seek and desire. They like people who don't have a high value in the environment and who view it as a resource to be exploited and used rather than preserved and conserved. And so what did David Patterson do that was signature to his gubernatorial administration? Sadly, he shut down the parks in the state of New York. Mm. And if that's an indicator of what can happen, you multiply that times the experience of people of color who are who are disrespected with regards to their voices and connectivity to the environment. And as whether it's the Nature Conservancy or any other big green organization turns its back on communities of color and deny their voices and rightful places in that conversation on land use and land policy in this country, and to build, by the way, a strong movement, then the private sector who will offer these communities jobs, who will offer these communities false choices and false hopes, at the end of the day, industry wins and the environment loses, and more importantly, we all lose. So the challenge to the green movement is, a challenge of self-enlightenment. If the movement wants to survive, it must engage the other half of America. My struggle with regards to the incinerator within the city of Albany, New York, was indicative of that. You know, like any civil rights struggle, you come together as a community, but your bucket isn't big enough. So one of the things that we do is we organize. This is a civil rights tradition. And so we reach out to a number of organizations. And let me say this, while we were not well received initially by the Sierra Club, we weren't initially well received by many environmental organizations. You know, the community at the end of the day received relief from the NRDC, which was the sole environmental entity to come in and help us litigate it. But NYPIRG wasn't there. The Sierra Club wasn't there. So it's a mixed bag. And so whatever the reasons and motivations for the disconnect, we need to look past that and find that, number one, there's no such thing as African-American or Hispanic or Native American air, African-American or Hispanic or Native American soil or water. It is just air, water, and soil, and we're all connected.
Let me just jump in here because I want to pick up on that and get Jackie Patterson back in on the conversation. Do we need to frame this in terms of, you know, white people versus minorities when it comes to issues of the environment, or is it possible to move this conversation forward, which I think Aaron is trying to do? Can you weigh in on that?
Sure. I think that those aren't mutually exclusive. I don't think that the conversation isn't going to move forward if one points out racial disparities. So I think that that's absolutely a necessary part of the conversation. But I think we can move forward with an acknowledgement that we should all have the right to clean air, clean water, clean land.
Amen.
Yes. So I think that it's a both and type of conversation that needs to be had.
But Jackie, do you think the environmental movement is kind of at a crossroads now? When it comes to diversity and inclusiveness?
I think that we're at a point, yes, where there is an acknowledgement that we need to be more intentional about having inclusive conversations and inclusive movement building. And so in that sense, I think we are at a point of realization and of transformation, what I hope is transformation. So, yes, in that sense.
Let me say this.
Yeah,
the planet is at a crossroads. The planet is at a crossroads. We cannot afford to, as they say, build a human rights movement, whether it's, as they say, separating and alienating civil rights, worker rights, environmental rights, and justice. The planet right now, we're facing a world challenge, and there's no planet B. Climate change is here. The very forces that have oppressed people of color, Native Americans, that have attacked most of progressive movements, human rights, women's rights, civil rights, LGBT rights, that very same conservative force right now still controls and dominates the regulatory conversation and the electoral conversation. Right now, the Green Movement is one of the places, and the NAACP and civil rights and labor movements coming together right now are the most critical links right now for us to really tackle climate change. The Pope issued the moral call. The Green Movement right now is not at a crossroads. There is a no return. If there anybody is serious about environmentalism, they must transcend the race issue. They must deal with that demon that's in the room. That's the elephant in the room. And we need to wrestle and beat it down and build a global and inclusive movement. Now, Sierra Club has begun this journey. It has a long way to go. But there are a whole host of organizations, the World Wildlife Federation, Greenpeace. There's all these other organizations that are out there that have huge ways to go. But even the foundations and funders need to talk about, if they're trying to be serious about saving the planet and saving wildlife and saving species, then they need to invest in this effort that builds a broader national and international movement to deal with climate change. And the only way that we can deal with this is deal with the demon of racism, exclusion of people of color. And as they say in the NGO world, the North-South divide, which is people of color from poor nations, we must bridge these gaps. We don't have, as they say, time to waste and lose. And more importantly, there's no planet B.
Well, no planet B, and I guess no plan B as well. To you, Adriana, if that is the goal, and it's hard to argue with that, so what are the issues, you think, to galvanize, let's keep it focused on the United States, to galvanize this country going forward?
Well, I think climate change, and I think both Aaron and Jackie put it perfectly well. This is a human issue. This is truly about mobilizing all of us on this issue. And I think climate change affects us all because I think that while air pollution does as well and water pollution does as well, I often think that we as humans are quick to dismiss things as, oh, that's not necessarily my problem, if we happen to perhaps live in a slightly better neighborhood than we could. And that's simply false, because it's true. These are human issues. These are not black, Latino, white issues. These are all human issues. So the nice thing about climate change is there is no question that this is going to affect every single one of us. This is our moment. Our moment is now to have every single one of us in the United States, no matter what race, creed, or color, come together and realize that this is our time to oppose the pollution that has been dumped upon our world by the fossil fuel industry, and to see that we can all do better. Now, one of the key reasons why it's so important for us to all be united on this is because, again, divided, we are going to fall here, because we are already seeing attacks by the fossil fuel industry claiming that these rules are not going to be good for people of color or for poor people, and that divisiveness is what makes them win. It gives them an opening. It gives the fossil fuel industry an opening to immediately divide our country. We cannot have that. We need to recognize that we all have a role in this fight, that every single one of us is going to pay more if we continue to buy into the fossil fuel industry's messaging. We have an opportunity to move to renewable energy, which means healthier families, healthier communities, and ultimately healthier pocketbooks for every single one of us. So we need to make sure that around climate change, we are all seeing the benefits to every single one of us. And that really doesn't matter where we live. Ultimately, there are co-benefits, of course, that are tremendous, like the direct pollutants from power plants. But the bottom line is that climate change is making it worse for anybody who has respiratory problems. It's causing a lot of problems that are going to affect every single one of us, as far as costs on food, costs on housing, costs on insurance, and costs on health. So we need to come together and realize that our country can do better, and that every one of our voices is important. That's why we're seeing this move by people like us on the call today, to make sure that we're including voices from the Latino community, from the African-American community, from indigenous communities, to weigh in and say, I care about this. Whether I'm a Latino business owner or an African-American doctor, this is something that is really important to me. Whether I am a teenager who's lived among power plants or somebody who has had the luxury of living a comfortable life in a great neighborhood. I care about this because I know ultimately it's going to affect every single one of us and the future of our planet. So climate change is truly the time for us to come together as humans to fight this and not allow the fossil fuel industry to divide us.
Jackie, let me ask you a very specific question. This has to do with renewable energy or things like solar energy. I mean, that tends to be expensive, and it's expensive for even middle-class families to try to incorporate that into their life. Where does that leave, you know, disadvantaged and low-income communities?
Fortunately, there are a number of mechanisms that have been developed to help to increase access. And it's not as, for one thing, it's not as expensive as it has been in the past, and it's actually getting to be competitive in terms of the rates of solar. And two, there are a number of different ways that communities have been able to come together to provide access for low-income residents. One is community aggregation, a way that communities can buy renewable electricity credits from solar and wind so that they are contributing to solar and wind and are able to get their electricity through that. Do that mechanism. Two is that folks are engaging around solar gardens where there's a collective ownership of solar gardens that aren't necessarily on one's individual rooftops, but that is a microgrid that supplies electricity for a low-income community. And there's other mechanisms as well, on-bill financing that takes away from the burden of a major capital investment and allows one to pay as one saves because of the savings from having your electricity from solar as opposed to fossil fuel. So we're seeing more of that, and that's actually one of the major things that the NAACP is working on, is A, making sure that folks understand what those mechanisms are, and B, to help to encourage the availability of those mechanisms as well.
Well, we are taking another short break. Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking about minorities, low-income communities, climate change, the environmental movement, Jackie Patterson, Aaron Mayer, and Adriana Quintero, our guests in this hour of Radio Times. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're taking a look at efforts to bring more racial and ethnic diversity to the environmental movement. Also, the disproportionate impact that climate change has on minority and poor communities. And again, our guests are Aaron Mayer. He's the new president of the Sierra Club, Jackie Patterson, director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program, and Adriana Quintero, senior attorney, director of Latino Outreach for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And again, we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think. Aaron, I know you wanted to say something. Let me just first get Jeff from Hocasin, Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Jeff, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Marty. I was listening to your guest talk about, you know, how different neighborhoods, you know, because they're black and or Hispanic, they're in the foreground of the, you know, big company. I grew up in Bridesburg. Which
in Philly.
Some people call of the cancer capital of America. I was surrounded by Roman Haas, Ally Chemical, and the Frankfurt Arsenal. And my neighborhood happened to be all white at the time. It's getting pretty diverse now. And I'd like your guest to touch on that. And also, I'd like to say about the stop and vote. I think in 2016, if you can't get a picture ID to, you know, voter registry, then you can't get a family member. I think it's too bad. That, you know, I don't think that's trying to stop anybody from voting. And I'll take your response off.
Okay, well, let me take your first point, and perhaps, Aaron, I'll toss this to you. And he's saying this was a neighborhood in Philadelphia he was describing, you know, home to a number of chemical plants. And he's pushing back on this notion that this is just about minorities. This is probably a, you know, working class white neighborhood in Philadelphia.
Right. And that goes right to the, you know, again, people tend to look at the environment immediate to themselves. And that's why you look at peer-reviewed studies and you do the data analysis. This is not something for the armchair or faint of heart. This requires people to do some deeper research. And like I said, I quoted and cited the 1987 Toxic Waste and Race. And one of the things it stratified was by income. And early in my comments, I mentioned that low income is, as they say, that bottom dumping ground. That's where the sacrifice zones are. So if you look at rural Appalachia, you have, in fact, the first People of Color Summit included everybody. It was a rainbow from poor whites all the way to indigenous, Native American, African American, people from all over. So poverty is the biggest threat. Because why is poverty the biggest threat? Because at the point of economic desperation, that's where industry can influence politics, politicians, buy local county governments, gets rules and things waived. And these communities that are the most economically vulnerable also start to become resource assets, especially when they sit on top of coal fields and coal reserves. So it's not surprising that poor white communities or blue-collar communities become sacrifice zones. So this is not to say that poor whites are not equally vulnerable. But the issue, even when you have amongst poor, and you can see this throughout the South with the dumping of PCBs and other contaminants in other landfills, the race does matter. So this is not a opinion. This is what the data shows. So, you know, again, for some folks, that may not be sufficient. But the issue at the end of the day, I'm a man of science. I, you know, am an epidemiologist by training. And so data analysis is clear. And so, again, we can have a back and forth, but that's where industry wins, right? Because people tend to focus on the race and not the fact that race and income becomes a point of vulnerability and exploitation by industry to get their way. In fact, even go back to the earlier point that I want to make before we went to break about the cost, for example, of green energy and how people are citing it as expensive. Again, that whole framework, it doesn't have to be that expensive, right? If we provide the right incentives, the right investments, if they gave the breaks and, as they say, the incentives and the dollars that they right now pour into billions that they pour into the oil and carbon industry to green technology and energy, we would have a much more cheaper footprint. Remember, early on in the solar field, we were denying startup companies, as they say, to build the panels here. In fact, companies were encouraged to go to China. So our technology, which began here in the United States, has been shipped to China and now is being sold back to us. And so the issue is not about cost. It's, again, how does the regulatory framework and the political framework get shaped to make things that could be cheaper, could be affordable, could be doable, to becoming something expensive and unattractive. And all you got to do is a quick metaphor is look at the post office, how Congress is mandating the U.S. Post Office prepay pensions well into the future, basically to create the situation of bankruptcy within the post office. So Congress, the people we elect, can decide and have a profound impact on how fast America can go toward a green economy. Do we need a new deal? No, we need a green deal. Okay. We need a green deal where these things are pulled together.
Right.
Jackie, did you want to say something?
It was Adriana. And
Adriana, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But poverty truly is, sadly, a great equalizer on all of these issues as well, and I think that Aaron said it very well. The key here is disenfranchisement. And I know that again, that's something that Aaron talked about earlier. Whether we're talking about poor white communities or black and Latino communities, by far the biggest problem is the disenfranchisement. And sadly, because of voting rights laws and other attempts that we're still seeing today, as the caller mentioned, those communities tend to continue to be more and more disenfranchised. When you're talking about the voter ID laws, all of these things continue to be by design intended to keep a certain part of the population disenfranchised and unable to take part. So again,
and pitted against each other.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're talking about poverty and pollution, there's an undeniable link. When you're talking about disenfranchisement, racially, there is a tremendous, tremendous impact that, fortunately for many, even poor white communities, has not been historically as bad, which is why things continue to be the way that they are, and that this is a self-perpetuating situation as long as we continue to have things, even today, moves towards voter ID laws and other things that are designed to keep people out of the process, to silence the voices that could be most affected. If we look at let's look at it more simplistically. You don't need to know anything about voting rights, and just look at the way that meetings are scheduled. If somebody is in a community that they're not aware of a meeting that is going to impact them, or by the fact of their language, or they can't get out of work, they're going to automatically be less able to participate in the process. And so we need to be very hyper aware of how we're doing this, because if you take a closer look, it's clearly designed to benefit people who have the ability to take advantage of that. And sadly, that has not historically been a racially diverse mix.
To you, Jackie, let me just put this question to Jackie. I'm actually looking at an article on the environmental health perspectives, and it looked at the effect of sidewalks and streets on poor urban neighborhoods, finding that they're literally just hotter than other neighborhoods within city limits. In many ways, there aren't the trees to provide the shade that can keep temperatures a bit under control. They talk about high risk heat islands. If we're talking about the impact, I guess, of climate change on poor urban communities, it seems to me that's a pretty good example of what might be going on.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So the heat island effect is certainly significant, given that the bulk of many communities, or people in general, live in urban areas. And then there's also the other impacts of climate change, that such as the disasters, and we find communities that are low income are less of a buffer against disasters. Don't necessarily have home insurance. The housing stock is more susceptible to damage from disasters, and countless other challenges there.
And by disaster, are you referring to Hurricane Katrina, for instance?
Hurricane Katrina is definitely an example. Certainly, Superstorm Sandy, and you know they're still making the ties in terms of these the tornadoes and the severity and frequency of these tornadoes. But the flooding that's happening in different places that are actually taking lives. Yes, so certainly.
And not ahead, just Aaron. Mentioning Hurricane Katrina and Sandy, but look at the disparate responses and reactions. Sandy hit. Granted, a large metropolitan area, but if you look at the responses to the affluent suburban white areas within the metropolitan area, which is the New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut areas that were impacted, versus what happened to the Gulf Coast and the African-American communities vis-a-vis white communities in the Gulf Coast post-Katrina, you see, you know, two dual realities. And one of the things that's very critical, again, goes right back not only just to the heat islands. Those heat islands are what I call, these are things that are zoning decisions, and whether or not a zoning board or a municipality decides to put a greenscaping as they would do in a suburban area, those choices when it comes to people of color in their communities, they seem to be optional. Mm. In the case of Katrina, again, the communities were dislocated, dispossessed, moved off the land, but even the actual response to the communities, if you were a person of color, you suffered the worst. If you were white, your communities got repaired. In fact, you just look at Haley Barber's Mississippi and the response between black and white communities. Again, this is all things being equal, poor communities vis-a-vis wealthy or middle-class communities. Communities of color tend to got second-class treatment. Hurricane Sandy, again, they made sure that the homes of millionaires and super high-income individuals were restored. Even though they were built in the floodplain, they were not admonished, they were not forcefully relocated and dispossessed. Whole communities in Louisiana to this day, New Orleans, have not been allowed to return schools. They use this as an opportunity to destroy housing authority projects. So the entire what I call ethnic relocation policy that occurred in the wake of Hurricane Katrina is a stark example of how racial inequity exists, even in response to climate change crisis.
Well, let me get, looks like Barbara from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. This
morning.
Is a wonderful show.
Thanks.
And I'm glad somebody mentioned the Pope. I know you're out of time, so I'll go fast.
Sure.
The people that I think NAACP and other people have to lobby are the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. The New York Times reported that they haven't even put it on their agenda yet. So the Pope is there. He's saying the earth and the poor are the same cry. But I say go to the U.S. United States Conference Catholic Bishops.
And put pressure on them. Jackie, is that something the NAACP wants to do?
Well, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops actually is engaging around these issues. We were, and we're part of a group called Interfaith Moral Action on Climate and also on the board of Center for Earth Ethics. So we do a lot around faith-based organizing and have been most recently in Bonn at the pre-meeting for leading up to the December UN climate talks. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops was definitely there. They are invested around these issues. I think that's certainly I've seen statements from them on this. So they do seem to be committed, and maybe that's
okay.
Getting
I'm
out
happy
there.
To hear that.
Yeah,
the,
Barbara,
saying,
yeah.
I am. And if anybody else can write a letter, that's great, too.
Okay, Barbara,
okay.
You
great
know, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me put something...
Can I just add something to that? Marty, I think it's so important, and I'm glad that both Aaron mentioned the Pope and your caller called out on this. I think that, again, this goes to the point that we were making earlier. The Pope was trying to say this is a moral issue. This is a human issue. We need to take action on this. Until we start looking at climate change as a human issue, we're going to continue to have just this divergence of conversations that are taking off on wild goose chases rather than really focusing on what matters most, which is preserving our lives and preserving and moving us forward in a safer, healthier fashion. That's ultimately what we need to do. And yes, fortunately, that statement came out. We anticipate others, as Jackie pointed out, from other faith leaders. We already saw more coming out yesterday. Additional voices joining. So every day, more and more religious leaders are joining this conversation. And as religious people, whoever is taking part in church activities, the key portion that I like to listen to about the Pope's message is we need to talk about these issues. Until we start talking about these issues and really raising them to the forefront, making them, as I'm saying, human issues, we're going to continue to have these political discussions. And frankly, if you look around the world, nowhere is this issue as politicized as here in the United States. And that goes to the bottom line, which is that the fossil fuel industry still has a tremendous amount of influence in our government. And until we break those shackles, we're going to be in a real bind.
The Pope called that an immoral peace. And the Pope highlighted that very clearly. He pointed out the greed and excess consumption by that carbon force and the denial science that it funds, one of the greatest threats to civilization and to our species.
Well,
and that needs to be underscored.
And we're almost out of time here. He seemed to also blame capitalism itself, Aaron,
for
the problem.
Absolutely. But let me get two things that are going on.
You got
again.
Probably time for one, but go ahead.
Okay. All green groups need to look at the Green 2.0 analysis, and everybody should be having some sort of DEI drafting diversity, equity, inclusion plan. And also I want to give a shout-out with regards to the NAACP, the labor movement, with regards to our Journey for Justice, which will be kicking off August 1st. We're starting the March for First Leg in Selma, Alabama, and I invite the country to be there to march with the NAACP, Sierra Club, communications workers, the Latinos, various Latinos groups, and indigenous Americans. Again, Journey for Justice kicking off in Selma, Alabama, August 1st.
We have to say goodbye. Aaron Mayer, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. He's the brand new president of the Sierra Club. Jackie Patterson, thank you for joining us. Hope you feel better.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program, and Adriana Quintero, thank you very much as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. She's a senior attorney, director of Latino Outreach for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.